You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. We're at AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2, also streaming online at will.illinois.edu. My name is Celeste Quinn. Today, we're going to take a look at the experiences of American women serving in the military in Iraq. Our guest is journalist Helen Benedict. She is the author of The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq. Helen Benedict tells the stories of five women who fought in Iraq between 2003 and 2006 in her book, The Lonely Soldier. Between their stories, she tells stories of other Iraq War veterans. Benedict reports that more American women have fought and died in Iraq than in any war since World War II. By September of 2008, 592 had been wounded, 102 had died. But Benedict also reports this in The Lonely Soldier. Yet, even as they increase in numbers, women soldiers are painfully alone. In Iraq, women still make up only 1 in 10 troops, and because they are not evenly distributed, they often serve in a platoon with few other women or none at all. This afternoon, we'll look at the problems that isolation can cause and ask what should be done to improve conditions for women serving in the military. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Helen Benedict is a professor of journalism at Columbia University, the author of 10 books. Her work reporting on soldiers has been honored with the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism. Benedict has also written a play based on The Lonely Soldier. The Lonely Soldier Monologues was staged in March of this year, March 2009, in New York City, and the play is available for further productions. Helen Benedict's book, The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq, is published by Beacon. You'll find our guest online at www.helenbenedict.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. The numbers to call if you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon. Helen Benedict, welcome. Thanks so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
My pleasure. The first soldier readers meet in The Lonely Soldier is a young woman, a veteran of Iraq. Her name, Mikaela Montoya. She told you no one would listen to her story because she was a woman. No one believed she had been in combat. Is that typical?
I found many women feeling that way, especially in the first few years of the war, because the usual depiction, whether on television or in documentaries or on the front pages of newspapers, was always of men. And women were very rarely shown, even in the pictures, never mind actually interviewed. So a lot of women really wanted to tell their stories because they felt that they weren't being recognized for their service, never mind some of the other issues.
Yeah, and it also strikes me as this maybe is part of the problem, because we don't think of women serving in combat. Other soldiers don't see women as combat soldiers.
Yes, it's very difficult, and it's reinforced by the attitude, well, not the attitude, but actually the rules from the Pentagon and the Defense Department, which is that women are still officially banned from ground combat, which has become an absurdity in the Iraq War because women are in ground combat all the time. But it does mean that with the official ban, it's still very easy for the public and for reporters to still believe that women, the women that are serving in the military, are all still in back rooms somewhere typing letters. It's an old-fashioned idea. It hasn't been true for a while. It wasn't even true in the first Gulf War, but a lot of people still think that. And that contributes to the invisibility of women soldiers.
Hmm. How did you find these women?
I began that through veterans organizations, many of which were mainly occupied by Vietnam veterans. but once they heard that I wanted to tell the stories of women and spread the word through the Internet, a lot of women came to me. And then whenever I met one, she would put me onto friends who'd put me onto friends. But they were, as I said, they felt so invisible, they were so eager to tell their stories, whether positive or negative, about their experiences, that it was remarkably easy to find them. I still get emails from female service members all the time wanting to tell their stories.
Yeah. I think I have a hunch that this is true of the soldiers serving now, men and women, that we're talking more about their experiences and their thoughts about the war than in previous conflicts.
Yes, we have a different culture now about it. It's partly Oprah and the proliferation of programs on television and where people are telling intimate stories, and we're more open. It's blogging, it's emailing, but also soldiers, a lot of them have, I use soldiers to mean all troops. I'm not mm-hmm. excluding Marines and Air Force and Navy and so on, but they're all, a lot of them have little cameras with them and iPhones and things like that, so YouTube is full of their own storytelling, in a way, their own visual storytelling. But yes, it's very different than in earlier wars, where typically veterans didn't want to talk about their experiences. And yet, it's still hard for veterans of the current wars to feel that anybody understands them or really wants to hear them. And in a sense, mm-hmm. that hasn't changed from mm-hmm. World War II.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call now for you, Helen Benedict, a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Thank you for coming to the program. I first would like to thank and show my appreciation for all the women that have served. I'm a veteran myself, and the first question that comes to my mind is, if you found out anything in talking to these people, what a baseline motivation, other than just being patriotic, would motivate a woman to want to serve in a combat situation? I mean, I just, you know, after I got out of the military, I didn't want to do that, and I questioned it deeply. And it seems to me that, you know, as a society, we wouldn't want our mothers and sisters to also have to engage in this type of thing. That, you know, I mean, just think of a mom coming back with, you know, and having post-traumatic stress syndrome, you know, and having to deal with a couple of children while dealing with that also. If that makes any sense to you, and if you have anything, any enlightenment to that, I'd appreciate it. And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
All right.
Sure. Actually, that was my original question that led me to writing this book, is I wanted to understand why women would enlist in the military. Or choose combat, which are not the same things. We have to remember that a lot of people who ended up in combat in Iraq had enlisted in the National Guard or in the Army Reserves and didn't expect to actually ever be sent to war, especially if they'd done that before 9/11. But women enlist in the military for the same reasons that men do, by and large, economic reasons. Wishing to serve their country, wanting adventure, maybe they're in small, dead-end towns with no job possibilities. They want to pay for college. Many of them, men and women, about half, actually, according to studies, are joining to escape dysfunctional, violent homes, and this is their way out. So that there are a lot of the same reasons that overlap for enlisting in the first place. Now, but we have to remember that the women who are in combat now didn't actually choose to be in combat, because I'm talking about ground combat, because they didn't expect to be, since they're still officially banned, as I just said. They ended up in combat because of the nature of the Iraq war, where there is no front line, where bombs come out, mortars come out of the blue, where you're driving along the road and you can be blown up by a roadside bomb or attacked by grenades or find yourself in a battle. And whether you're in the infantry or in something called combat support, which means you may be driving in the same convoy as the infantry or right next to an infantry vehicle, you're all in the same boat, and you're all ending up doing the same thing. Also, because of the shortage of troops in this war, a lot of women ended up being gunners and really being in battle. That said, just as there are some men who are drawn to combat, this is true of some women. And we can't stereotype women in thinking of them all as motherly and gentle. Some women really want to fight for their country. They find the idea a powerful, invigorating way of living their lives. Some of them really wanted to fight back because of 9/11. Even though Iraq was the wrong place to do it, but not everybody knew that at the time. Basically, I think women should be allowed to choose whatever job they want. They're fully adults. I wouldn't choose to be in combat, and the caller didn't want to do that either. But there are some people, some men, some women, who do, and luckily, otherwise, we'd have nobody to fight for us.
Hmm. Are the motivations, women and men, similar for enlisting?
They are. As I said, there are all the economic reasons, and which we're familiar with, reasons. A lot of people, it is patriotic, or they want to give back to their country by serving. And some of them want the adventure. And then a lot of them, men and women, want to prove themselves in some way. You want to show that you learn to be tough, to be leaders, to have responsibility, to be physically strong. This appeals to people. Those are all many of the reasons, but I did find some studies that are a rather sadder reason, which is that half of the men who joined the military were physically abused as children, and half the women were sexually abused as children, and many were both. So there are a lot of people who join as a way out of unhappy homes and home situations, in a way to escape, a way, if you like, to find a new life for themselves.
Is the military aware of that, and is the military taking that into account in training?
Not officially, although these studies which showed this were done in conjunction with the VA. Informally, people know this, are very much aware of this, especially about the women, I think. I've heard lots of anecdotes about drill sergeants referring to, you're not going to let your husband beat you up anymore, that kind of thing. It's accepted. But I don't think it's widely officially recognized, and it's certainly not addressed in training. No, it's not addressed at all.
Hmm. Journalist Helen Benedict is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, if you'd like to call in. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The five central figures in the story, The Lonely Soldier, what did they tell you about what they had learned from their experiences in the military and in war, good and bad, generally?
Yes. Well, there's a big difference between their experiences in the military at home and their experiences at war. Some of them say that the two in particular who'd been career soldiers and had been in for a long time had got a lot out of their careers. They were both in the army. They were both in the reserves, so they had been able to train in jobs and careers at home and give their families and their children better lives than they'd had themselves growing up. And they'd learned, they were sergeants, and they'd learned authority and discipline it's enormous capability that you learn when you're in the military. When they went to Iraq, it was really different. When they saw the number of starving children and the bombed-out towns and the civilians who were being killed, they really began to question what we were doing there and what they were doing there, and that was very hard on their conscience. Then from the younger ones, a lot of their idealism had been quite destroyed because of sexual harassment and sexual assault, which is a huge problem for women in the military. It's almost a pervasive problem. Some 90% of women in the military are sexually harassed by the men on their own side, and that just wears your spirit away. So you might go in with all this idealistic stuff about how the army or whichever your branch is your family, your brothers and sisters, your comrades, and that gets completely eroded when they're constantly harassing you, let alone if they actually sexually assault you or rape you. And so I heard a lot of that from many of the soldiers I interviewed, distressing amount.
Yeah. Why don't we let you get a sip of water, and I'll reintroduce the program and you. Helen Benedict is our guest this afternoon. We're talking about the experiences of American women serving in the military in Iraq. More than 160,000 women have served in Iraq since the war began 6 years ago. Accounting, though, for just 1 in 10 soldiers, women often serve in units with few other women or none at all. This is also one of the problems that we'll talk about in a moment here on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest, Helen Benedict, is a professor of journalism at Columbia University. She tells the stories of 5 women who fought in Iraq between 2003 and 2006 in her book, The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq. And the book is published by the Beacon Press, and you'll find our guest online at helenbenedict.com. That's www.helenbenedict.com. Better?
Yes, it's all these seeds flying around.
It is that time of the year, isn't it?
Yes.
I have a little trouble with that myself, and I think today I'm sounding a little deeper than usual.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about one of the women central to the book, just out of training, Abby Pickett. She was assaulted by an officer while another officer pretended to be asleep.
Yes.
And she wasn't the first in this particular to be assaulted by this particular officer. What was going on there?
What was going on is what goes on only too often, which is the a senior officer, in this case he was a lieutenant colonel, taking advantage of a new young female of much lower rank who'd been trained to look up to officers and admire them and see them really as father figures, and on top of that, of course, had to obey them because those are the rules of the military. So the hierarchy in the military gives senior officers a huge amount of power over their juniors, and they with very little consequences for abusing the power and very little recourse for the ones who are abused. So it's really a perfect setup for anybody who is inclined to abuse their power, and that's what he did. I mean, what happened was they were on a humanitarian exercise in Nicaragua. This was before she was deployed to Iraq. She was 19, and he ordered her to go walk into this area with her, which was very isolated, and this other officer who then lay down pretended to sleep, and he assaulted her. And afterwards, she heard from other people that he did this to a lot of people, and nobody knew who to tell or how to tell. Nobody expected to be believed. And so she just, at first she was so shocked that somebody she looked up to would do this to her, and that you know these officers who were supposed to be so admirable would do this, that she just didn't know where to turn, and so she didn't tell.
Yeah. How has that affected her?
It really shook her very deeply for a long time. And it was the thing that happens in the military. It's not like being harassed or assaulted by your boss at the office, because you can go home. But when you're in the military, you can't go home. You live with these people 24 hours a day, week after week, month after month, year after year. There's nowhere to turn. and you have to keep seeing the person who assaulted you or the people who are harassing you. And it stays with you. And so when she was deployed to Iraq, she was deployed with a unit that had only recently admitted women at all. And it was what she called an old boys climate. And they were very good old boys. They were very hostile to having women with them at all. It was an engineering unit out of Wisconsin. And so they were constantly harassing her, shouting vulgar remarks at her, treating her as if she was incompetent, watching her all the time, waiting for her to mess up, which made her extra self-conscious. In fact, she was a very good soldier, and she ended up in Iraq saving people's lives under a bomb attack in extreme danger. But she could never shake this feeling of not being able to trust her own comrades because of this assault and because of the harassment. I mean, how can you trust somebody who's yelling vulgar sexual remarks at you all the time?
Hmm. Why are women unevenly distributed among active duty troops?
Well, in Iraq, only 1 in 10 troops is female. And you're deployed according to the job you're trained for, not according to what your gender or color or anything. So women are just put where they're needed. And because there's so few of them, it doesn't take very long for the unevenness to show. I mean, even if it were even, there'd still be only 10 women per 100 men. So sometimes you end up in a unit with 2 or 3 other women. Sometimes if you're in a medical unit or some of the military police units, there are more women, which helps. But sometimes you can be all alone, or, you know, there might be 2 or 3 other women, but they might be in different squads and go off to different areas each day so that you're essentially alone with men all day long. But I did interview one young woman who was, her whole platoon was male. She was the only female of some 60 men, 50, 60 men, she told me she was with, alone for months in Iraq.
And what was her experience like?
Oh, it was terrible. She was very young and naive. She came from a country family, and she'd gone into for religious reasons. She felt that she would be able to spread the word of God and so on. And so she was quite young and naive and idealistic. So she wasn't prepared at all for the atmosphere. And she was harassed a lot, and then her own sergeant assaulted her more than once. And when she reported these things, she was told, it seems the problem is you. So she was transferred to another unit in another base, which was just as isolated for her. It was just she was just as outnumbered, and so it wasn't any better for her. And her sergeant who'd been assaulting her was promoted. I don't know why, but she was, of course, furious. She doesn't know why, but he got a promotion, and she had to wait a long time for hers, much longer, 6 months. And then she was harassed again at the next place she went. And it so undermined her as the months went on and it didn't stop that she came home with such trauma from it that she was suicidal.
Mm. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign County. Line 1, hi.
Hi. This really does seem to be ubiquitous. I attended a speak out by Iraq Veterans Against the War, and 3 of the 8 people were women, and so they were overrepresented. And 2 of them had stories of harassment. One of them went as far as saying that she was a truck driver, so she didn't really interact too much with Iraqis. But on the base, she was most worried about getting mortared or her GI comrades harassing her. And I know there are other stories of bases where women couldn't go to the latrine at night, that they would have to use chamber pots or whatever because they just couldn't risk and didn't want to put up with what they had to, which wasn't always, you know, terribly extreme. Sometimes it was just mild harassment, if I can say that. That sounds actually kind of odd when I speak it. But so it just strikes me as and this isn't new, so I just don't know what the military, whether there's any any movement. I guess, you know, the whole thing is it's not the priority. You know, the priority is the occupation, the attack, or whatever, maintaining morale or something, which is why it seems to always just get shoved under the rug and people just get moved to another spot. Well, I just wanted to contribute that because these testimonials are available, and I don't know how many you've collected, I'll just hang up and listen to your reaction. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I interviewed about 40 women who'd served in Iraq and Afghanistan, mostly Iraq, for the book, and then I read veteran studies that were more statistically significant, where they had interviewed hundreds and hundreds of women from several wars. And the statistics I came across are 30% said they were raped while serving. That's almost one in three. Around 71% sexually assaulted while serving, and 90% harassed. So the numbers are enormous. I'd like to talk in response to the caller's comment about harassment. It's kind of hard to understand why harassment is so traumatizing, because it doesn't sound so awful just to have sort of derogatory remarks or sexual remarks. It sounds almost just like typical boy teasing. But it's important to remember that firstly, you're completely outnumbered. So it's a threatening situation because of that. Secondly, you can never get away from these people, so it's relentless, day and night, day and night. At the beginning of the war, many of the soldiers I talked to had been sleeping in the same quarters, same tents as the men. They had no separation from the men ever. But most important of all, sexual harassment is a way of conveying a message that says, you are an outsider. You are not one of us. You are inferior to us. We resent you. That's what it actually says. And when that is being thrown at you day in and day out relentlessly, it completely erodes your spirit. There are studies that show that women who've been sexually harassed can suffer many more times of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, than even combat can cause. That's how serious it is to the spirit and the psychology of a person. So it is to be taken seriously. I do have a note of hope, I am happy to say, which is that how this is treated and stopped and dealt with has almost everything to do with the individual commanders of any given unit. And actually all the officers from the lowest sergeant all the way to the top. If a commander respects the women in his unit or her unit genuinely and gives a genuine command and creates the atmosphere that disrespect, which is at the root of all these assaults, will not be tolerated, and that he will keep his platoon clean, not by burying the problems, but by dealing with them properly through all the proper recourses, prosecution, investigation, and so on, then it makes a difference. Then there will be less problems for women, and there will be more justice when it happens. I've heard that a lot, and that's where the hope lies. But if the commander tries to keep his unit or platoon squeaky clean by hiding wrongdoing and by intimidating complainants into silence, or by actually engaging in the harassment or assaults himself, which is often the case, then, of course, the signal goes to all the soldiers that it's free rein against women.
Hmm. One of the things that I found disturbing and at first it's shocking, and then when you think about it, it's like, well, how do you root this out? The misogynist language that is so deeply ingrained in military culture, the songs that one marches to as a soldier, woman or man, they're beyond the pale in my book. Is there any progress in that regard?
There is. I mean, racist language was banned a while ago, as were curses. So when you watch those old movies of drill sergeants screaming those things, they're not allowed to scream those things anymore. and I have heard that there's moves now and to also ban the worst of the sexist language. So they may not be able to use, you know, some of the vulgar words about women, but it's still common for a drill sergeant to denigrate his recruits as part of the breaking them down as civilians and building them up again as soldiers, just by calling them girls or calling them women or calling them ladies. None of these are dirty words on their own, but it still gives across the impression that there's something shameful about being female and something weak. And that's in civilian life, too. I mean, men don't want to be called women. So it is really pervasive in the culture, and that has to change with time. I mean, I've heard some people say, as the old guard, the older sergeants and older men in the military who are more hostile to women being there, age out, it will get better because younger men are more used to treating women and seeing them as equals. That's a huge generalization. It might be true in some cases, but there are lots of exceptions. But it is a matter of changing the culture, and so it's not enough just to make a lot of rules on top. It has to be done in all kinds of ways, including training, promotion of women, giving women recognition for the combat they're actually doing, giving them more recognition for the work they're actually doing, rewarding them more, giving them more power themselves, and so on. I mean, there's a long list of things that have to be done, and some of them are beginning to be done now, but we have still a long way to go.
Mm. Two of the women that you focus on in The Lonely Soldier are career. I don't know where they are at the moment. Ellie Painted Crow, a Native American, and Terrace DeWalt Johnson. That's not her real name. She's an African American woman. What were their experiences in the military? What's the experience of women of color?
Well, very interesting, different and the same in different ways. Terrace, the African-American woman, the reason I had to change her name is because she re-enlisted, so she's still in. She joined the Army when she was about 19, and she was in the Army Reserve, so she went back and forth between active duty and inactive duty. And she really enjoyed her career a lot. She rose to a sergeant, and first sergeant, I believe, and she was very successful at it. And when she was in Iraq, she was actually made a convoy commander, which means that she was in charge of a convoy of up to 24 giant trucks driving through Iraq from the top to the bottom and back again with all the bombs and firefights. She was in many of those. And she was often the only woman. Everybody driving, all the other soldiers, all men. So she tells the story of one time arriving at a base, and she was greeted by the soldiers at the base, and they said, "Well, where are you going to sleep? And we don't really have any equipment to give you a separate sleeping quarters." And she said, "I'll just sleep on the truck with the guys. You know, I sleep with my men here." Not in the sense that sounds, but you know, just like any soldier. But she talked about one problem she had a lot as a woman, and more she talked about this in terms of being a woman rather than being a woman of color, which is not being listened to. She said it, and she has a personality. She can be really tough and really loud. She can be a real, really, you know, a real sergeant personality when she wants to be. So she knows how to make herself heard, but she said she would say something, make a suggestion or something to an officer, and she would be completely ignored, and then a man next to her would say the exact same thing, and he would be recognized for it. And this has happened to her constantly in her career. And she was actually talking to Ellie Painted Crow about that, because I brought my soldiers together at one point to meet each other when the play was going on. and they had exactly the same experience, and indeed they both talked to me about this independently before they talked to each other as a very common experience, not being heard, not being taken seriously. Ellie Painted Crow had 22 years in the military, in the army. She's retired now. And she also experienced a lot of racism, and she told me the story of a white major, who was in fact a woman, who was in charge of her unit, who fired basically all the soldiers of color from their positions and made them train white soldiers to take their places, and then made the soldiers of color into the assistants. And when she tried to speak up against this, she was punished. And the most dramatic thing she told me was when her commander said, when they got to Iraq, "It's Indian country out there, go get them." And she, being Native American, she said she found that very shocking. She said, "I was wondering if I was on the wrong side." Mm. So they both talked a lot about the discrimination against them as women, not being listened to and not being taken seriously, and how difficult it was to make yourself heard without losing your temper, because if you try to battle against this being ignored by blowing up, then you just got dismissed as a hysterical woman. So you had to always keep your cool, but just get fiercer and fiercer and more, you know, forceful in the way you talked, all while in control. So, yes, they spoke about that quite a bit.
Yeah. I want to go back to Makila Montoya. I found her enlistment experience unbelievable. And I bring this up because it goes to enlistment efforts in our high schools.
Right.
And it's something we all need to be aware of.
Right. Yes, she went. She grew up in a Mexican neighborhood in East LA, quite a poor neighborhood. And the recruiters, military recruiters from all branches, were in her high school all the time. So much so, she doesn't even remember the recruiters from other careers. They were so overshadowed. And they would come by, her recruiter, the one who got her, would come by and blasting hip-hop out of his window and take the kids to lunch and call them up at their homes. And after 9/11, the military made a huge effort to recruit this way because we were so short of soldiers. So they especially targeted, as they still do, high schools in poorer areas and immigrant areas where they knew that there were fewer other options. And then the No Child Left Behind Act help them out, because part of the deal is that to receive federal funding, schools had to agree, and this is still true as well, to give the names and addresses and phone numbers of every single one of their students to the military. And you actually are allowed to opt out of it, but you have to know this, and you have to know that you've got to write a letter saying you opt out of it. So if you don't do anything, your child's phone number and so on will be given to the military, and then recruiters will call and sometimes visit your home and court. They just court you. They court your child and until they've got them. I actually gave a talk in L.A. at a community college there, and a great many of the students in the audience were from Michaela's area, from Rosemead and other poorer areas of L.A., and I asked them, I think there were 200 students in the auditorium, and I asked them, how many of you had recruiters in your high schools? And almost every hand in the room went up. How many of you had recruiters coming to your home? About three-quarters of the hands went up. So, yes, it's a very aggressive pursuit of the young.
And as we're coming down on time, I want to reintroduce you, and then I've got some questions about resources out there designed for female veterans.
Sure.
Helen Benedict is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a journalist. She's the author, most recently, of The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. What do our women veterans need, and are they getting what they need?
Well, they're not. Most of them are not yet, but there is hope on the horizon. They need counseling. They need for sexual assault and also for combat trauma combined. And the VA is behind on this, but it's catching up. There are some centers around that really have good counselors now, but they're having a lot of trouble getting veterans to come in, partly because it can take a long time to get your benefits after you come home from war. So there's this months of waiting when you're in this limbo. You need help, but it's not coming, and nobody's paying for it yet. But also because for those who've been sexually assaulted, having anything to do with the military or an organization that reminds them of the military, including the VA, is too horrifying to contemplate. A lot of VA hospitals, all of them were originally built for men, and the women's wings are often just a separate little part of it. So they're still full of men, and they often only have male counselors and male doctors, and you know, most of the patients are male. So a lot of women don't want to go anywhere near those places because it just reminds them of the trauma all over again. But there is a new organization called SWAN, which stands for Service Women's Action Network, and which is a non-military, non-VA organization set up by women veterans, especially to help women vets who feel this way, who need help getting their benefits, getting medical help, getting psychological help, help sometimes finding homes, because homelessness is a big problem now, finding shelter. And they can be found on the web at www.swan.com.
Okay, very good. Let's take another call. A listener in Savoy on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I am listening to your program, and I have a happy addition to make to it.
Okay.
I served in the Marine Corps for 2.5 years, World War II, so you know that I'm not a youngster. But never once in those 2.5 years did I hear anything said about my being a woman or being a female. It was an amazing situation, and you would expect it, but not once in 2.5 years. I just came out with a wonderful feeling. So I thought I should tell you that, and that things have not always been so bad.
Yeah, let's get Helen Benedict here on this. Is this, you know, women have been in the military for a long time. For generations, is the situation different? Is it worse than it's been in previous conflicts and previous wars?
Well, it's hard to say. The problem has always been there, but I never said it happened to everyone. I mean, if one in three women are raped, that means two in three aren't. And the harassment isn't universal. It does depend on who you happen to be deployed with or who you're serving with, because it's certainly not true. I don't ever mean to say as if I'm saying all the men are like this either. I mean, most of the men I've interviewed in the military are just as horrified by this as I am and want to fix it. What I can say, the studies have shown that there's always been a problem with harassment and assault for women in the military. They didn't talk about it in the past as much as they are now. They didn't report it because the support and the understanding wasn't out there. It was a much more of a no-no subject. They don't tell each other about it either. So it's easy to have the impression that it didn't happen. And then if you're lucky and you have a wonderful unit and experience, which many people do, like the woman who just called, and you never hear anything else from anybody else, you don't really know whether it's not happening or just people are covering it up, because people usually do cover it up. Hmm. But studies have shown that this is not a new problem. There are some indications it might be getting worse, but it's really hard to tell yet from the statistics whether that's true, because you can't really tell if you're comparing people's willingness to talk or actual incidents.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here. The final question I have for you this afternoon is saying that some women Many women, perhaps, would say that they had a very good positive experiences serving in the military. And there are women out there who would like to enlist. Any advice you have for young women trying to come to that decision?
Yes. I think they should go in with their eyes open. Too many have no idea what really faces them. They should read the books that are out there and watch some documentaries. They can watch Lioness. They should read book memoirs by women, soldiers, and listen to programs like this one, and just go in with their eyes open. I do think that the women who work in units with more other women tend to have a better time, but you don't usually have any control of that. I mean, there are certain, like medical units, that more women tend to go into. There's certain jobs that more women gravitate towards, and it helps, of course, not to be that isolated. The main thing is to go in with their eyes open and be prepared for what might happen and think about how to deal with it.
Mm. There we have to leave it. Helen Benedict, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Helen Benedict is the author of The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq. The book is published by Beacon. She's also written a play based on The Lonely Soldier. The Lonely Soldier Monologues was staged in March of this year, March 2009, in New York City, and the play is available for further production. So maybe we'll be seeing that one of these days. Helen Benedict's book, The Lonely Soldier, published by Beacon. You'll find our guest online at www.helenbenedict.com.